Well, I guess with that, we'll get ready to start the session today. We have a number of speakers who will be joining us. I think we're going to start with Steve Diamond, who spoke during part one of the seminar series. For those of you who weren't involved, Steve is a chemist with more than 15 years of experience, including 4 years in a commercial analytical lab and 8 years in environmental consulting. He actually came aboard here at EPA in 2005 and is focusing his work on enhancing acceptance and use of emerging analytical technologies and sampling strategies. Mr. Diamond's efforts have actually resulted in the development of numerous EPA case studies, profiles, training courses, and strategies for use and understanding of collaborative data sets, adaptive QC programs, and real-time analytics. Our actual primary speaker today, though, will be Ms. Zena Crumley, who also works here in the Technology Innovation Program and holds a bachelor's degree in biochemistry and a master's in environmental science. She has over 20 years of experience as an analytical chemist in a wide variety of situations and has worked in the hazardous waste arena for how many years now, Dina?
About 15 years.
Within TIP, she focuses on supporting the acceptance of field analytical methods and improving the quality of hazardous site characterization through systematic planning and adequate QA/QC procedures. So with that, again, one last friendly reminder to please place your phone on mute if you have not done so already. And starting on slide number one, I will turn things over to Steve.
Okay, thanks, Jean. Before we get started with Dina's presentation, we've allocated about 20 minutes here to try to cover some of the questions that we had from Module 1 that Bob Johnson gave this past Monday, August 4th. And we answered a number of questions, as many as we could, during the time that we had allotted on Monday, but we've got a number of questions that went unanswered, so we're going to try to tackle as many of those as we can here in the next 20 minutes or so. And if folks are interested, you can always go back and look at the archives, as Gene mentioned. Again, a number of questions were answered through the auditory portion of the program, and we also are putting together or compiling some of these questions and answers so that we can revisit some of the more complex issues as part of the session number 8 here at the end of the month. So with that said, I'll just jump right into the questions. And if Bob Johnson wants to add anything, hopefully he can jump in here on the phone line and add anything. First question, are there measurement issues when the soil matrix and physical characteristics of the spiked calibration sample are very different from the in-situ soil being tested? And the answer, actually Bob gave an answer to this partially during Monday's session, and essentially yes, the answer is yes, there are measurement issues when you have differences in the soil matrix and the physical characteristics of the spikes, if you're using spike samples. And Bob gave an excellent example of that with his example for uranium, the uranium site, where they had both a fine powder type matrix and a more loamy matrix, that they were unable to get the same calibration to sufficiently characterize those spiked samples. So that's an example of that. So certainly the matrix is going to have an example or an effect on the physical characteristics and the measurements that you get from the spike sample. Next question. Is the effect of concentrations of other elements on the recorded value for a particular element of interest always the same, or does the strength of the effect change per contaminant element? Well, actually, there's really two effects going on here. The first is an inter-element interface, and those effects are element-specific. So the relationship between specific elements within the matrix. And again, as an example, elevated lead will not only potentially bias arsenic results, but it could also raise arsenic detection limits. And we have some examples of this both in the DMA portion coming up and also the QC module number 5 coming up here in another couple weeks. The second effect is more global. As metal concentrations increase for individual metals, analytical error and detection limits were also increased for other metals. And we showed some examples of, Bob showed some examples of that on Monday, and we see this effect when individual metal concentrations are significantly elevated or approaching, when metal concentrations are approaching the percentage range. And Bob showed you some examples of what to watch out for in the use of regression for comparative analysis with XRF and ICP. And one of the examples showed the effect that you can have on the linearity of the instrument as concentrations get up into percentage levels. So hopefully that answers that question. Next question. Do the different EPA regions or states view XRF as definitive data with the right QC program? And is this becoming more accepted as definitive by regulators and able to be used for risk assessment? This is a great question, and the short answer is maybe. Our group here in the Technology Innovation Office, we've engaged EPA regions and state folks and the risk assessment community on this very issue, but the potential to use XRF for risk assessment or as a definitive, quote-unquote, definitive data with limited or no collaborative data remains very site and regulator specific. So you really need to talk to your project team, and of course, using a demonstration of methods applicability and some of the other QC concepts that we'll introduce you to later in this series of seminars will go a long way in helping you to try to get that implemented in your program. Now, the regional EPA risk assessment community, they were introduced to the benefits of a higher density data set, albeit slightly lower analytical quality, the type of information that XRF can provide. And in a few cases, we've been able to significantly scale back requirements for collaborative sampling via laboratory methods like ICP, but only after a demonstration of methods applicability had been completed and extensive development of site-specific relationships were developed. Dina recently has an example, a site example, where that took place at a RCRA site. Overall, though, we've seen an increase in the acceptability of XRF over the last few years for risk assessment and definitive purposes, and we expect that trend to continue. As I mentioned earlier, one of the best ways to present XRF data for those purposes is to ensure high-quality, legally defensible data through the use of good QC requirements, documentation, and reporting. Do you want to add anything to that? No? Okay, next question. Is there any rule of thumb for measurement time in the field? Bob discussed this again in the basics module on Monday. We go anywhere from, 30 seconds to 600 seconds off. So there isn't really a rule of thumb for what's an appropriate measurement time in the field. Oftentimes people will default to a 2-minute or 120-second reading with the field portable instruments, which can provide sufficient live time, if you will, to get acceptable detection limits and error rates. And as part of the DMA module, which I'll be presenting on August 14th, part of that is the determination of appropriate operating procedures. So what the demonstration of methods applicability helps you determine is, among other things, your QC program and other things, is also what is an appropriate operating procedure for the instrument, i.e., how many seconds and count times do you need to do that. So appropriate measurement time ultimately depends on how the sample is prepped, whether you're using it in a bag or cup or in situ, the variability of the matrix, the presence of other elements of interest, as Bob noted, your desired detection limits, how the instrument's used, and operator skill. So a good rule of thumb, since I didn't really give you one to answer that question, might be that in general it's anywhere on the order of about 30 to 240 seconds, but operators have the ability to increase times upwards of about 600 seconds or as few as 10 seconds. However, when you get down in those lower, shorter count times, most matrices are not amenable to that because what happens is you end up with a non-detected value because the value the instrument thinks it sees is often less than 3 times the standard deviation of the counting statistics, which Bob described on day one, and how we calculate, how instruments, XRF instruments calculate detection limits. So moving to the next question. Is there any loss of quality going from a benchtop XRF to an in-situ or handheld unit? And our experience has been mostly with the handheld units. However, a variety of handhelds and benchtop models have been evaluated under EPA programs like independent technology verification reports. And I actually participated in some of those studies that were completed at the Kennedy Space Center in 2005 and 2006. And in general, my experience was that the handhelds performed as well or better in some cases than the benchtop models. So we didn't see a huge degree of variability between the field portable instruments and the benchtop models. But we also considered other things like the ease of sample preparation, the throughput, how many samples we could get through in a specific time through the program, portability, and the need for consumables like liquid nitrogen as a cooling agent or other types of things. All of those things were considered under the evaluations. And I would encourage folks to go to the EPA.gov website and look under ORD, the site program, and also the ITVR program, Independent Technology Verification Report program, and take a look at the work that was done at the Kennedy Space Center. There's I think about 8 or 10 different vendors that came down and analyzed 300 different samples, blends from all over the country, different types of matrices, different concentrations of different contaminants, and those were all published in reports by EPA. So you can kind of get a feel for, you know, how the field portable units and also the benchtop models stacked up against each other. Next question. When averaging data from bagged samples, what's the best number of readings to take to get the most representative average? Well, unfortunately, again, there's no rule of thumb here. This is really a function of the variability within the bag and your expectations of acceptable decision error rates, and we'll talk more about that in subsequent modules. And we've even developed a spreadsheet that we're lovingly referring to, the XRF Toolbox, that can help assist you in these types of evaluations. But again, there's not an established best number of measurements. And as a general note, it really depends on what you intend to do with the information. So, for example, you could, if you're screening samples against a particular threshold and you're simply interested in determining for individual bags, for example, whether the contents are less or greater than a threshold, you can develop a dynamic strategy where the number of measurements per bag would range from one to many depending on what you observe in that initial measurement. And we'll give you an example of that in subsequent modules. I'll cover it in the QC piece, and I believe Bob has some excellent examples in the later modules 6 and 7 where we talk about dynamic work strategies and developing decision rules. So we'll give you some examples of that later on. But if you're interested, for example, in getting a quantitative value that will be pooled with other results to reach some decision, then that's a slightly different story. In that case, it's important to recognize that the variability is almost always a function of the concentration level, so the concentration that's present in the sample. So with higher average concentrations, you would expect to see more variability in an unprepared bag, and the greater the number of measurements that would be required then to get a good average representation of the result for that bag. So hopefully that answers that question. We've got a few more minutes, so we'll try to get through some more of these. Actually, I think those are mainly the ones that we did not cover from last week. If anyone had additional questions, if anyone is on this week and you didn't have any questions that we did not answer, just shoot us an email, or when we get to the question session here today, we'll try to answer those questions. And again, we're going to try to compile all these and revisit some of these as part of the session, the last session on August 28th, I believe. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dina, and we will delve into the concept of representativeness.
Starting on slide 4. Hello, everyone. We're talking about that mysterious concept called representativeness. We talk about it a lot, but often the meaning of it is not very clear in work plans or in project reports. Representativeness doesn't just happen by itself. It needs a foundation. If you go to slide 5, you can see how we start that foundation with tying representativeness to a specific decision. So there's all kinds of decisions that we face in the cleanup business. Some of them have to deal with our contaminants above background levels. Is there any human or ecological risk? Are contaminants above cleanup criteria? And if so, how should the cleanup proceed? Can cleanup be optimized or can it be stopped? So there's all kinds of decisions that need to be made. Each decision may require a different kind of data, a different level of quality of the data. And that concept of representativeness is critical to getting the data to answer the question. We go on to slide number 6. Obviously, the most wonderful thing for us was if we had fast and cheap methods that could run lots of samples and also provide definitive data. But reality is such that sample analysis and collection is expensive, it's time-consuming. Therefore, generally only a few samples are collected. And there's measurement errors and interpretation issues that exist
but these are not always recognized, and they're seldom quantitated. So although analysts and sampling crews all know that there are measurement errors due to heterogeneity and other issues, these often do not get communicated to the decision maker in a way that the decision maker can take them into account. If you go on to slide number 7, we find that representative sample is defined in regulation. In the RCRA section of 40 CFR, there's a definition where it says that a representative sample means a sample of a universe or a whole, for example, waste pile, lagoon, or groundwater, which can be expected to exhibit the average properties of the universe or the whole. So, there's the regulatory definition, of course, and the question is, what does it mean? We see it does tie representative to an average of something, but the definition there really evades several questions, one of the most important of which is, how do you take such a representative sample? If we move on to slide number 8, some of the questions that can come up from trying to determine what this RCRA definition really means is the fact that the language is unclear as to whether a statistical sample or a physical sample is intended. A statistical sample is actually a group of physical samples, whereas a single sample is what field people and cleanup people are usually more used to thinking of when they hear the term sample. Statisticians use the word sample differently, and that's to mean a group of physical samples. But the RCRA definition isn't clear about what is intended there. Does it imply that you can just take one single grab sample and use it to represent this whole universe that the regulation refers to? Under what conditions could you expect a single tiny sample to represent the average of a whole large universe? Well, that's reasonable only if you can assume homogeneity. But can we really assume that? Let's go on to slide number 9, and we'll look at other definitions of representativeness that are in the literature. There's an article in Environmental Forensics in 2005 that was published by Chuck Ramsey and Alan Hewitt, which some of you may know. They have a lot of field experience in researching this idea of what is sample representativeness. And so the answers that they supplied in their article, one of the bullets there, it shows that it says a representative sample is one that answers a question about a population with a given confidence. Now, a corollary to that is that a sample that is representative for a specific question is most likely not representative for a different question. And I think those definitions start getting to the heart of the matter. First of all, we don't talk about a universe, but we talk about a population. Really a population of interest, some volume of material that we're trying to make a decision on. And it's very important, this idea that if you collect data that's representative for one thing, and it truly is representative of that one thing, then trying to take that data and force-fit it into making another decision can be a dicey proposition. We move on to slide number 10. So let's take a specific example where we can walk through some specifics to help clarify the concepts. First of all, we're going to say that our intended decision is whether the lead concentration in soil exceeds a regulatory limit of 600 ppm for the top 4 feet of a 10-acre lagoon area. So we are defining our population as the top 4 feet of a 10-acre lagoon area. And say for the sake of this example, we're going to take samples of 4-foot cores, and then a 400-gram soil sample is taken from the center of the core, and then a 1-gram soil subsample is taken from the 400-gram sample jar, and that 1 gram is what's analyzed for lead. And say the analytical result from that 1 gram is 75 ppm of lead in soil. So the question is, does the lead concentration exceed the 600 ppm limit for our population? Well, we've only got one result. So we need to ask ourselves, what does this analytical result really represent? In other words, how confident do we feel that the 75 ppm result represents the average concentration for the 4-foot core, which it initially came from? And then do we believe that the 75 ppm can be extrapolated from the core to the 100 square yard grid block area from whence the core came? If we move on to slide 11, we can look at this graphically step by step. Break it down. We have a little graphical representation of our 10-acre lagoon, and from that we've taken a 4-foot core. And we're going to ask ourselves, do we assume that there's enough heterogeneity across the whole lagoon that if we take a few cores, we can assume that the concentration of the cores is equivalent to the concentration across the whole lagoon? Moving on to slide 12, we're going to further then take a sample from the core, about 400 grams, put it into a jar, which is going to be shipped to the lab. So the question, or the assumption that we're now making is, I'm going to take a field sample from that core. Does it matter where I take it in the core? Should it be from the top or the bottom? Here we selected to take it from the middle. Or maybe it should be taken a little bit from the length of the core. How homogeneous do we think that core is as to where we should take that sample and how we should take the sample? Moving on to slide 13. Once the core gets to the laboratory, they're perhaps going to dump the whole jar out and stir it around in order to take a subsample. Maybe they'll just take part of the jar and put it in a pan and stir that around before they take their subsample. Maybe they just open the top of the jar and scoop off the top. If it's not written down, we probably don't know how it was done. But for this example, we're going to assume that they took 20 grams from the jar. So again, we can ask ourselves, well, do we think that the 20 grams from the jar in the lab pan is representative of the whole 400 grams originally in the jar? If we go on to slide 14, again, breaking this down step by painful step. So we're going from the lab pan now to an analytical subsample. For metals analysis, which for XRF, that's what it applies to, is metals. For ICP analysis, or AA, the amount that is actually extracted is somewhere between a half a gram and 2 grams. 1 gram tends to be the consensus as far as most labs tend to use 1 gram, but I've talked to some that use half a gram, and I've talked to others that use 2 grams. But somewhere in that area is the mass of soil that actually goes into a digestion flask and gets solubilized to release the metals into solution. Moving on to slide 15. Then we're going to take a little portion of that digest and inject it into the instrument in order to get a result. So then the question is, can we assume homogeneity when we take the liquid, a portion of that liquid digest, and put it into the instrument. And I would argue that of all of these instances that we've covered, here I could assume, I would feel comfortable assuming homogeneity. And why? Because it's a liquid. And it's easy to mix up. Before, we were always dealing with solids, and they are very difficult to homogenize. And then if we go to our last slide in this group of graphics. So, that summary question, can we assume representatives over every step in this long process? You might notice there, when your slide comes up, that the result that popped out of the ICP was 23.456 ppm. And sometimes that number of significant figures actually gets reported to the data users, and because data users often don't understand the concept of significant digits or data uncertainty, they believe in all of those six numbers. Our current cleanup practices put a lot of faith in making that final result represent the concentration of the original amount of land from which it came from, in this case, say, 100 square yards by a 4-foot depth. But for people that commonly work in the field taking samples or work in laboratories analyzing them, as individuals, we often have doubts about this process. And as we go on to slide 17, I'm going to show you from some real data sets why you should listen to your doubts. What we see here is an example from an actual project, an actual soil sample taken from a firing range. And it illustrates that even within a single jar of soil, there is heterogeneity. There are different populations, and those populations are based on particle size. This firing range soil was collected, a large volume was collected, and the aggregates were crushed, but you know, things like stones or small stones and things were not crushed, just the aggregates. It was then sieved through a series of sieves so that it got sieved into six different bins with the particle sizes there given as meshes. The exact mesh isn't that important at this point, but the pattern that is important is that the larger size particles are at the top, and as you get down to the larger mesh sizes, the particles get smaller and smaller. You get down to less than 200 mesh, and you're talking dust. Are pretty fine particles. And for each of those size fractions, each was analyzed separately by atomic absorption in this case. And hopefully you're noticing a pattern where the larger particle sizes can have very, very low lead concentrations. But when you get to very small particle sizes, those particle sizes can have very, very large, very high lead concentrations. This is due to a physical reason. There's two reasons why this occurs. One is the fact that those very small particle sizes tend to be clay minerals. Clay minerals tend to have a negative charge. Metal ions tend to have a positive charge. Therefore, they like to stick together. So those tiny particles tend to attract and hold the metal ions to themselves. The other important aspect of those fine particles is the finer the particle, the higher the surface area that things have to stick to. So there are physical reasons why we see lead concentration going up markedly as particle sizes get smaller and smaller. Now, this effect, called a particle size effect, can be very, very important to what happens when we subsample soils and materials, especially in a laboratory where, at the end, we're going to be taking only 1 gram of soil, thereabouts, half a gram to 2 grams Not 1 gram of soil is going to actually get digested by the acid. So the instrument is only going to see the metals that come from that 1 gram of soil. Now, how is that 1 gram of soil taken from the jar? Is it taken with a fairly large spoon? Is it taken with a small spatula, with a flat blade? Depending on the tool that's used, the size of the bowl, or whether there is a bowl, that tool will preferentially retain some particle sizes over others. Larger particle sizes may roll off. The finer particle sizes will probably stay on a small spoon. I think you can see that just based on the tool, you are more likely to sample the small particle sizes which have high lead concentrations. Another factor is when you're trying to weigh out those small volumes, the small masses on a balance. If you're getting up towards a gram and you're trying to get close to a gram, anybody who works in a lab knows that you start tapping your spatula to tap in a little bit at a time to get your mass close to your target. What are you tapping in? You're tapping in fines. Preferentially, you're tapping in fines. On the other hand, say that when your soil jar got to the laboratory, it had jiggled its way across FedEx and the roads and into the lab in its cooler, and maybe the lab, when it got the sample, it just opened the lid and scooped off the top. Well, again, for those who work with soils, you know that when you jiggle it, shake it, the particles separate. The larger particles tend to rise to the top, and the smaller particles tend to go down. So if somebody just goes in and scoops off the top, it's quite possible that they're going to preferentially get larger particle sizes. I think what you can see from this is, depending on a whole lot of factors that no single person has control over, you can get just about any lead result that you want, depending on whether you go for larger particles or smaller particles or some mix in between. And with all this variability, it's kind of no wonder that when we split soil samples and send them off to two different laboratories, we get different answers back, sometimes only a little different, sometimes wildly different. And, of course, the question is, who's right? I mean, it's possible that they're both right, and it's also possible that they're both wrong. It depends on what target you're holding up as far as what's right. If you're asking about representativeness of the sample, then you have to say, well, what's the decision that I'm trying to make on this sample? And I'm going to give you two examples of decisions just to draw a contrast. For this particular site, again, the issue is a military base with a firing range. And like all military bases, it has an issue. The suburbs are growing up right next to the fences. And so there was a concern that the lead-contaminated soil from the firing range could blow across the fence and into the suburbs and into people's homes, where it could stick to little kids' hands who then put them in their mouths and get exposed to the lead in the soil. If that is the decision, if that exposure scenario is the decision, then you ask yourself, what particle size fraction is representative of that kind of decision? What particle size fraction is representative of an exposure decision based on dust blowing across a fence and sticking to kids' hands? Well, obviously, it's not the larger particles, it's the dust-like particles. And obviously, they are the more dangerous because they hold a lot of lead. Now, if we didn't pay attention to that decision, and we decided that, no, we want the average, so that we went for an average concentration for this bulk, then tried to apply it to the decision scenario involving a risk decision, You can see from the average there that's been a weight average, not just a straight numerical average, but a weight average for that sample. The lead exposure calculated on the average for the sample would be about half of a child's actual exposure. So let's look at a different decision. Say the decision is that, yes, this soil does need to be removed, and it's going to be dug up and taken to a landfill. Well, when that soil goes to a landfill, it has to be tested first, and it's tested with the TCLP.
Toxicity Characteristic Leaching Procedure.
Thank you. The man with the magic words at his tongue. When that test is done, what particle size fraction do you think should be tested? Well, let's think about it. If this soil is removed and put into a landfill, what gets put into the landfill? Under our current scenario, the bulk average, the bulk of the soil is being put into the landfill. No one particular size fraction is being singled out. So the proper particle sizes to go into the TCLP test is all of it. The whole bulk gets tested by the TCLP. Hopefully what you're seeing is, if you know what the decision is that you are trying to make based on this data, dealing with these complications that nature throws at us really isn't that hard. But if you're trying to determine what a representative sample is when you don't know what the decision is going to be, you're in an impossible situation. Let's go on to slide number 18. This is data from another project. This was a project that the Department of Energy did way back in 1978. They were testing a radioactive material in soil, americium-241. What's nice about radioisotopes in soil is that there are methods that are able to measure the true mean for large sample volumes, which is not the case for our chemical methods. But what they did in this study is they took large sample, like 2 kilograms, they dried it, ball milled it, and sieved it to less than 10 mesh. Then from that 2 kilograms that's been prepared pretty well, they took 21-gram subsamples. They analyzed each of them. The range of results is presented there in the second column. So the range of results for those 20 individual subsamples was from 1,010 to 8,000 ppb. The variability in those 20 data points amounts to a coefficient of variation of about 0.8. The ramifications of that kind of variability in the soil is that if you are trying to estimate the true mean of that original sample based on the results from 1 gram subsamples, to get an estimate of the mean that was within 25% of the true mean, you would have to take 39 1-gram subsamples, analyze each of them, and then average them together to get an average that's fairly close to the mean, to the true mean, which, because we have RAD methods, we know that the true mean was 1930 ppb. Now, if you wanted an even better estimate of the true mean, that you wanted your result to be confident that you're close to the true mean, so that you want it within plus or minus 10%, and there's that range that's given there. I also give you the ranges of what plus or minus 25% means and what plus or minus 10% means. You would have to take 240 1-gram subsamples, analyze them all, and then average them to get an estimate that you can feel confident falls within that 1737 and 2123. And that's pretty scary. because this sample prep is better than most everything that we do routinely, and yet it shows that the variability inherent in these tiny subsamples is very, very high. And although we tend to only take one subsample and analyze it once and then hang our hat on that number, we really have to ask ourselves how much confidence do we really have in that metal result. If we go on to the next slide, which is slide number 19, we can see the follow-on to this, the more other parts of this study, because they not only analyzed 1 gram subsamples, they also took 20 10-gram subsamples, 20 50s, and 20 100s, and analyzed those the same way. And you notice that as the volume of the sample, the mass of the sample, gets larger and larger, the amount of variability in those 20 data points gets less and less. And the number of samples you would need to analyze to be confident that you're within a certain percentage of the mean, that to be confident that you're close to the true mean, gets less and less. Well, our chemical methods have a lot of problems trying to analyze samples that large. So we have to look at other ways to deal with these problems so that if we do only analyze 1 or 2 subsamples, that we can feel confident that we can trust the numbers that they're giving us. If we go on to slide number 20, I'm going to talk a little bit about data uncertainty, this fact that there's variability in data, and what does it mean for our decision making? On the slide, as it comes up, you should be seeing a number line. The center of that number line is the 1930 ppb from the previous slide example. And the numbers there on either side of the mean represent the uncertainty at plus or minus 25%. What this level of uncertainty means, and what any kind of data uncertainty means, is that if you have plus or minus 25% variability in your data set, and you get a number that lies within that group, between those two boundaries, you cannot claim at 95% statistical confidence that any of the values within that group are different. Now, what does this mean for decision-making? What it means is if you have an action level of 2300 and you get a result of 1930, can you have statistical confidence that the result is below the action level? No, you can't, because both values lie within the confidence limit around the data point. On the other hand, if the action level were 2500, and you get 1930, can you be confident that the result is below the action level? And that's yes, because the uncertainty around that data point does not overlap with the action level. Okay, moving on to the next slide, which is 21. So where does quality control come into all of this? Now, we talk about quality control a lot, and we insist that people do it and that they report it and generate a lot of paperwork. So how do we interpret quality control to help us make decisions, whether it's about XRF or about metals in general or any analyte for that matter? Well, often we have acceptance limits for QC. So I'm going to use the example here of a lab duplicate. And in this case, we're going to say that the lab duplicate result is allowed to be plus or minus 30% relative percent difference. Now, that number is different from lab to lab, from situation to situation, from project to project, so you can't hang your head on the plus or minus 30% situations. It may be plus or minus 20%, other labs plus or minus 35%, sometimes it's plus or minus 50%. What we see, though, is if we get a result of 350 and our kit allows us to have variability of plus or minus 30% relative percent difference, that translates into an uncertainty interval that goes from 259 up to 473. This means that this measurement system's acceptable noise is such that values, oops, there's a typo, should be between 259 and 473, cannot be distinguished as different to the measurement system, and the amount of variability that it has when it's analyzing laboratory duplicates, that's the best it can be expected to do. So, we go back to that issue of data uncertainty. If between those levels, you can't tell the difference between different numbers, we have to be really careful about making conclusions about whether we're above or below an action level, because the random noise in our measurement system may not allow us to conclude that a number is truly lower than our action level. Can you stop there for questions?
I have another point to make to this slide, too, as well, as for folks who have either read or, God forbid, had the opportunity to write a data quality assessment. Oftentimes what happens with that, even if you exceed that 30% relative, that 30% relative percent difference, the data might be considered estimated. And it may, in the case of metals, receive an estimate qualifier. But that result, that end result, in this case 350, we'll say the end result was 350, is still used as 350. So now we know that we can't tell the difference between 259 and 473, yet we're assuming that the value is 350 ppm, even though we are outside of that 30%, that 30% relative percent difference that has been assigned as a QC factor. So what happens is when folks evaluate the number, whether or not they even get the qualifiers associated with it, the number is not then scrutinized additionally, or they try to expand the range of concentrations that would be considered, noise, if you will. So that's an additional level of uncertainty that goes into the number. The number may or may not be qualified as estimated, but then that result is still used, like you said, with the initial ICP evaluation example of 23.475. It's still 23.475, and it's estimated. So you can see that this thing can really, those bounds, that 259 to 473, can actually expand around a number, yet we're still making decisions with that number.
Sure, we can take time for some questions. A reminder, if you haven't done so already, you can use the orange question mark icon on the top of your slides to type up a question at any point. Feel free to do that now. For those of you on the phone lines, feel free to press #6 or unmute your phone and go ahead and identify yourself and speak up if you have a question for the instructors.
Everyone's just in shock out there.
That's right. You guys have such a phenomenal job. I don't hear any questions coming in on the telephone line.
Was there a typo on 21 that you said?
Yes, there is. In the text, it says 359. It's the 259 that's up there on the
of course.
On the bar is the right one.
All right. Got it. Thanks.
Well, if we don't have any questions coming in on the phone lines, again, if you've unmuted, go ahead and put yourself back on mute. You can do that by pressing *6. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to type them up for the instructors in advance using that orange question mark button. We will get them and address them later on in the session. And I guess we'll continue on.
Okay. The next slide is number 22. And one of the things to think about is this idea of definitive data. Certainly we talk about it a lot. Everybody wants it. What does that mean? There is a definition for definitive data that's in the DQOs for Superfund guidance. That's from 1992. Some of you may still have an old paper copy on your shelf. If you turn to page 43, you'll find the definition. There's actually a table of characteristics of definitive data. But one of the most important ones that was in that list, and I think the most ignored one in that list, is where it says that for data to be definitive, either analytical or total measurement error must be determined. And that means that we should be looking at those kinds of error bars or confidence limits, whatever you want to call them, that shows that just because the machine reports out a number doesn't mean that that number is exact, that there is always some amount of uncertainty around that number, some range where the true number may fall. And depending on a lot of variables in our system, especially when we are trying to analyze soils, the actual uncertainty of those data points can be very wide. According to the DQOs for Superfund guidance, we should know what those, what that amount of uncertainty, that error, is. And I don't think I've ever seen it done in a project I've been involved with, although there may be some out there that have actually determined the error and reported it to the data user so that they know how to interpret the data. You can go on to slide 23. And we're going to introduce a term to help us think about some of these concepts. It's actually a term that's helps us talk about it. The term itself doesn't seem very intuitive, and I apologize for that. The term is actually used in the DQOs for Superfund guidance, so that's why we've continued to use it here within our office. The term is support. And what this term comes from statistical folks, unfortunately, and they don't always use the most intuitive terms for us people that work at the ground level. But what the term means is it captures the fact that the volume of the matrix is a key determinant of what the measured result is. As I said, that this term has appeared in EPA publications for many years, but I can wager that it's a term that is probably new to a lot of people out there. It was new to me when I first started working with these issues of heterogeneity and uncertainty. But it's a very critical concept. We can go on to the next slide. And we'll give a little more detailed definition of the term sample support. Sample support encompasses the physical properties of the sample that are relevant to the representativeness of the sample. And some of those physical properties, the most important ones, certainly that we need to look at, so we need to look at the size of the sample, whether it's mass or volume, the shape and orientation in three dimensions. You know, are we looking at a shape that's sort of like a brick? Or are we looking at taking a soil sample from a 2-inch core that goes down to 2 feet and pulls up a 2-inch core? Those are two completely different sample supports because they have a different shape and orientation. Even though at the end they might have the same mass, they're still different sample supports. Go on to the next slide. Slide number 25. One of the reasons this concept of sample support is so important is the fact that we saw with our example with the lead in the firing range soil how the lead tends to accumulate on those very small particle sizes. So they become like little nuggets of highly concentrated contamination. One of the issues that we deal with is in our regulations and our field practices, the way we go about our business, we act as if we assume that no matter what size sample we take, we're going to get the same analytical result. Now, the data that I've shown you hopefully helps you understand why it doesn't work out that way. And this is just a really simplified graphic to illustrate one of those points with the nugget effect, that if you take a larger volume of soil but only happen to capture a certain mass of concentrated nugget, you're going to get a lower concentration result from that larger volume of soil than if you captured the same volume of nugget in a smaller mass of cleaner soil. That's going to have a higher concentration. That's pretty intuitive. Now let's go to slide 26. Kind of this graphic builds on the one before. Again, this is very much a cartoon, but it gets the point across about what happens in reality. The two panels, one represents a higher concentration of contaminant, the other represents a lower concentration of contaminant. But the higher concentration, again, these things are stuck to little particles. With a higher concentration, it's more likely that those particles are pretty well scattered about because there's a lot of them. With a low concentration, they're scattered about as well, but their density is a lot less. One of the issues we face is the fact that we have to operate at a lot of different spatial scales in our business. We're making decisions on very large areas that encompass tons of soil at one time. Whereas when we take samples and analyze them, we're taking little tiny samples that are very small compared to the actual volume of soil that we're going to extrapolate that result to make a decision. And then once the sample gets to the lab, they're going to take an even smaller amount of soil that actually gets analyzed. So the ideal of sample support, the idea of how large is the sample that we're taking from this parent matrix, becomes really critical, because really small sample supports are really unlikely to capture the same number of particles from one sample to the next. So the really small sample supports, and hopefully you're looking at this in color instead of black and white, but in color you see the smallest sample support is those little red boxes. And even in the high concentration, because those little boxes are so little, when you place them randomly, sometimes they pick up a particle and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they pick up two particles instead of one. So if you analyze that little box of soil, sometimes you'll get a non-detect, sometimes you'll get something in the middle, sometimes you might get something really high. On the other hand, you can look at these larger sample supports, like the mid-size, which is the light blue box, and if you place them randomly, again, on the high concentration side, there's chance involved in the particles that they pick up as well, but because they're larger as compared to the distribution of the particles, it's more likely that those concentrations are going to be pretty similar from one sample to the next. It's pretty unlikely that you're going to get a large sample support in that high concentration area that turns out to be non-detect. You'll have some that are higher, some that are lower, but they won't be nearly as extreme as if you're taking those very small samples. Of course, when you get to the low concentration, again, there are much fewer particles, and they're scattered further apart, so you may or may not pick up one. Again, you may get a lot of non-detects, but then get one or two that have higher concentrations. This, in fact, is what we see in our sample sets, in our data sets. We see, it's called a log normal curve, because we see a lot of very low concentrations or non-detects, and then we see a few that are really high, and then sort of a scattering in the middle. It's interesting that when you actually take very large sample supports, your data distribution will go from log normal to normal. And that's because you are now taking a sample support that is better matched to the physical conditions of the matrix that you're actually sampling. And you get a lot fewer extremes of non-detects versus really high. We can go to the next slide. So there's another example from a data set. This is from, again, a radioactive analyte. This is uranium. And again, because it's a radioisotope, there are a variety of ways to measure it. It can actually be measured with XRF, which you see denoted there at the far left of the graph. But this graph shows on the bottom is the sample support in grams. So how large is the sample? At the far left, it starts out very small at about a gram, and then it goes all the way up to a whole lot. On the y-axis, we have the minimum and maximum data results that you're likely to get when you take a sample of the various sizes and analyze them. And this comes from another DOE data set. What you can see there on the far right with a very, very large sample support, oh, and then the true concentration, the true average site concentration is that line there that runs right down the middle. The larger the volume, the closer all of your results, all of your individual results are going to be to the true average. As you get smaller and smaller sample supports, the variability in your data set gets larger and larger. And then the normal and the log normal distribution is overlain there, again, to show you that those very small sample supports will tend to give you a log normal distribution because you'll have a lot of very low ones, and then they tail out to a few very high ones. Whereas if you've got larger samples, larger volume samples, you're going to get a more normal distribution, which is a lot easier to work with statistically and can give you a lot more confidence in any conclusions you draw from the data. We are going to examine this graph a lot more later and in the subsequent part two of representativeness, but so we'll leave that graph for now and come back to it.
I want to answer a few questions.
We've gotten a couple of questions that have come in online.
Okay. We'll try to get through two or three of them here. What type of action would you suggest be taken when, for example, the relative percent difference of a lab duplicate is greater than 30 and the result is close to the action level?
Well, there's a number of things that can be done, and you're probably not going to like the answer to any of them. One of the things to do is to do a better job of prepping the sample, of making sure that the representativeness chain is intact. That means from the time you start the project out in the field and collecting those first samples, you have to be sure that you have identified what your population is and how you are going to work your way down from that large core to a small jar and then in the laboratory to their 1 gram. That's something that has to be thought about and work through, and once that sample gets to the laboratory, or even before you send it to the laboratory, it's going to have to be subsampled in a way that ensures its representativeness. Now, in part two, I am going to go into that in a lot more detail. Here, we're pretty much trying to lay the foundations, and we will get to that in a lot more detail. So let me say that one option is a lot better sample prep along the way, not just in the lab, but from the field on through the lab, more homogenization. The other option you can do is take more data. Take more replicates and average them. See how close they are.
The second part of the question is kind of the flip side to that. Is if the result is, for example, 350 ppm and the relative percent difference is greater than 30, but the action level is significantly higher, for example, 2,000 ppm, would you consider this representative or usable for decision making?
Yes, because your result is way below your action level. So it is representative of a decision that says you are way below your action level. There is no uncertainty there, unless there's a, you know, a total goof-up somewhere along the line and the sample's mislabeled or the lab gave you a totally erroneous result. But statistically, assuming that that 350 is an accurate result and your analytical system is under control and you know what the analytical variability and the subsampling variability is, then that is an acceptable result, and you're done.
So the rule of thumb is you can live with higher variability as long as you're further away from your action levels, be it higher or lower.
Yep.
Next question. Do any state or federal regulators actually do this with their data? And I'm going to make an assumption here that this is in reference to the slide where we showed a value and then put a range of concentrations at the 95% confidence limit. And if I'm misinterpreting that, please send us another message or jump on the phone line, but that's my interpretation of the question. Does anybody actually, do any federal or state regulators actually request that information?
I don't know of any off the top of my head. We have used it and shown regulators the benefit, and then, you know, they will ask us to provide that with them, you know, the next time. So I think they see the benefit once they see that it can actually be done. And it's not that difficult if you plan it into the process from the start. But I think most people are not fully aware of these issues. And even if they are, they're not really aware of ways to fix the problem, or certainly ways that it can be done cost-effectively. So I think as more people come to realize that it can be done cost-effectively and that it really makes their decisions a lot easier when they have data that they really have confidence in, I think we'll get more and more requests for things like this.
Okay, this next one's just a consideration. It says one thing that you might want to consider is the fact that when you're evaluating data for that 30% RPD for a lab duplicate, how applicable is it really to the rest of the batch? In other words, how representative of the rest of the population is that duplicate?
Well, what you may be asking, and you're right, it's a little ambiguous, so you can clear this up for us if we've got it confused, but one way this question can be interpreted is, did that batch contain more than your samples? In other words, were other people's, other project samples, or their samples are totally different from your samples, or are they part of the batch, so that the lab duplicate may have been run on samples that are not from your site, yet they are applied to your data set. And if that is the case, you don't know how to interpret your data set because if you do not have a duplicate result for your samples, you don't know how variable your results can be.
That, and as a former lab guy, that is definitely the case where if you don't have at least 20 samples going into a batch, from an analytical method perspective, you're oftentimes lumped into a batch with other soil samples from other sites, different matrices and the like, and then whichever one happens to provide the necessary material to do the duplicate, which may or may not be specified by the folks providing the samples, then you are held to that duplicate precision as part of your batch, regardless of whether or not that matrix actually matches the matrix of your particular sample. So that is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. So it does show it's important to request duplicates on your own. Want to read the next?
Yeah. Next one. When using XRF in the field, how are soil matrix considerations handled?
We're going to get to that. We're laying the foundation right now for when we get to talking about the best way to use XRF in the field, we want you to understand why, because we're going to talk about things that are going to sound like a lot of work, and most people say, oh, you don't need to do all that, it's just overkill. It really isn't. So we have to show you why it's important to do those things. So we'll get to that.
Okay, just a couple more, and then we'll continue with the slides. When using an XRF in the field, is there a mesh size that is more appropriate for different individual metals?
I would tie it back to the decision. I think now some of the guidance in EPA for lead, because so many of the decisions we make on lead have to do with exposure of children to contaminated soil. I think there are procedures now that are either recommended or required that they do look at the small particle sizes. Again, it depends what the decision is, so there is no set answer. Always go back and ask what the decision is. And if somebody expects you to come up with a sampling design and they're not telling you what decision you're trying to make with that data, you have to tell them that you do not have enough information to come up with a design until they tell you how they're going to use the data. And that's just basic science. So they really should understand why you need that information to do a good experimental design.
Next question. When using the larger sample supports, aren't you getting a diluting effect due to the distribution being averaged over a larger area?
Again, we're going to talk about this in more detail, but the fact is, what does average mean? Is it average over a 1 gram sample? Is it average over a 400 gram jar? You know, what is it that you're trying to make a decision on? Generally, you're trying to make a decision on a plot of ground out in the field. That's what you're deciding on. Those little samples that you're taking and analyzing is just a way to get at what's going on out in the field. We're going to talk about how you set decision how you set your decision areas and decide what is the area over which you average. So we'll get to that. It's an excellent question. It comes up all the time, so we will cover it.
I think some of Bob's slides, particularly in Module 6 and 7 on the dynamic work strategies, will really get into the notion of what, and when he starts to talk about composite samples and multi-increment samples and associated sampling schemes, we'll get into the notion of how sample size affects, or whether or not it affects concentration within the sample. So we will get to that, Dina's right. And then just one last sample, and then we'll jump, one last question, and then we'll jump back into the slides. Is the sample size as support referring to the field sample or the aliquot that is actually analyzed? In other words, if you collect a 1,000-gram sample, but you're only analyzing a 1-gram sample, do you still get the benefit of the larger sample support?
Very good question. The term support can be used with all of those smaller and smaller subsamples. Just be clear. I tend to use things like, the phrase field sample support, so that you know it's the volume of sample that's actually being extracted from the matrix out in the field. Then if it's going into a jar, you might call it, the subsample support or the jar support. When it gets to the lab, depending on how many times they subsample, they will have different supports as they get down small to smaller and smaller until they get to that analytical sample, the sample that actually gets digested or extracted for analysis. And you could talk about the analytical sample support as far as, what mass are they using, how are they selecting a particle size and such. If you collect 1,000 grams in the field, and then you don't do anything to it except reach in and grab 1 gram of sample with a little scoop, there is no difference than if you took that little scoop out to the field and took a little scoop off the top of the ground, or, dug down in the ground and took a little scoop. If the only way to get benefits from those large supports is if you process that sample so that you maintain the representativeness. And representativeness in this case means that once you have that sample from the field sample, once you've decided how that field sample should represent your population, you maintain your representativeness by making sure that every particle of that original sample has an equal chance of being sampled as you subsample further and further down. You don't, you know, if you don't want to be selecting for a certain particle size, then you don't want your tool, your subsampling tool, to be selecting for a particle size for you. So if you collect 1,000 grams in the field and want to maintain representativeness, you can use a, and we'll talk about this some more later, a G technique to subsample, or you can grind the sample. There's a variety of options, but yes, you have to do a lot of work.
We get the benefits of the larger sample size.
And I think we'll go back to stay on track with time.
Okay.
So returning to slide 27, which is where we left off.
Okay, we can move on to slide 28. Now, we've been talking about variability within a sample, which is really important because we tend not to think about that a lot when we're collecting samples. One source of variability I think that we do think about a lot is the variability that comes from between samples. And between samples can be on a lot of different spatial scales. Between samples could be, you know, a sample is placed every 100 yards, every 10 feet, depending on your sampling design. In this case, they were looking at very short scale heterogeneity. So they were looking at samples that were on the order of only 2 feet apart. They're different samples, but they're pretty close. And this is on the order that people generally think of when they think of co-located samples. This, again, is actual data from the field, from a study that was done by the Corps of Engineers Research Lab. The analyte was TNT. What they found was that there was extreme heterogeneity on very small scales, such that if you picked up a sample, you know, a grab sample at location 1 versus picked up a grab sample at location 3 and analyzed them, you could, and those were the only samples you had from that area, you could come to completely different conclusions about how contaminated that area was. Not only were they looking at the short scale variability in the field, but they were also looking at differences between running an on-site method, which was a colorimetric method in this case, versus the off-site laboratory method, which was SW8468330, which is the HPLC method for explosive residues. And what they found was that the difference between two entirely different analytical methods was very, very small compared to the amount of variability that you can find in the samples in the field. In fact, if you do an analysis of variance, you find that less than 5% of the difference in that data set is due to the different analytical methods. 95% of the variability is simply due to where did you pick up the dirt. Understanding this kind of variability is critical if you're going to interpret results. This is also one of the reasons why multi-increment sampling is gaining importance, because it helps control for this type of decision error where one sample can give you a very misleading impression of what's going on in the field. Move on to number 29. And this graphic was just an attempt on my part to try to show the spatial scales involved in the samples that we take and analyze and the volume to which we then try to extrapolate that information. In other words, we say that these little samples, we're going to use those results to apply to this whole volume of soil out in the field. So the volume of soil that's modeled there is equivalent to 100 square yards to a 6-inch depth. And I had to turn it into a cube to make it fit on a slide in any meaningful way. But you can see how teeny tiny a 2-gram sample is and a 10-gram sample is compared to that huge volume of soil. And we're going to take the results of that 1-gram or 2-gram or 10-gram sample and apply it to that entire block of soil. That's what we do on a routine basis. We can move on to slide 30. How do we pick the right sample support? We need to pick it so that it can represent the specific population of interest. That means that before we can start picking sample support, we have to know what the population of interest is. To talk about that, we need another concept, and that concept is decision unit. We can go on to slide 31. This idea of decision unit is a fundamental concept for project planning and planning for data collection so that we can ensure representativeness of those samples and the analytical data we get from them. A decision unit refers to an area or a volume of material or a set of objects, like a set of drums, that gets treated as a single unit when you're making a decision. We can go to the next slide. Some examples of those decision units are something like an exposure unit, which is used in risk assessment, a remediation unit, which is a volume of soil that's going to be remediated all at once. I apologize if this figure is slow loading up, because it's a graphic, I guess. The picture is a little slow, so try to be patient, make sure everybody gets to see it. But I'm trying to give an illustration here, using drums as an example to show what we mean by decision unit. Here we have, and hopefully your graphics have loaded by now, ours have, so I'm hoping they're representative of your graphics uploading. What we see here is what you would find perhaps in an abandoned landfill. You've got all kinds of different drums. They have different, they're different colors. Some labels are still on, and they're all different from each other. A lot of the labels aren't there anymore. Some of the drums are leaking, different colors of things. Some smell different. So you've got all these drums, and these need to be characterized, transported, and disposed of properly. So the question is, what is the decision unit and how do you sample it? And when I ask this question in class, you know, everybody knows the answer, so I'm assuming you do out there as well. But it's pretty obvious because all of them are different. You're going to need to sample every one of them because you have to know what's in each one of them, even to handle it. So do you want to pick it up and have it explode on your truck, or release toxic vapors, or you know, is it something pretty innocuous? Each one of those drums is going to have to be analyzed to determine that. On the other hand, in the next slide, we're going to contrast that with a different scenario involving drums. Hopefully this is loading for you reasonably quickly. In this case, we have drums that have been used, but they're now being washed because they're going to be crushed and recycled back into metal. And they're getting washed in a process of steam cleaning and things, and they're washed in batches. So these drums get grouped into batches, and you need to ensure that the cleaning process worked. So now the question is, what is the decision unit, and how would you sample it? And again, when I ask this question in a live class, everybody knows the answer. And it's pretty obvious. A batch of drums is the decision unit, because you're going to assume for that batch they were all treated the same. They should all have pretty much the same characteristics. The cleaning worked well, or it didn't, because, you know, it didn't get hot enough, or the operator didn't take enough time on it, or whatever. Therefore, you are able to statistically sample that batch. You don't have to sample every drum, but because they should share similar characteristics, you should be able to statistically sample so that you only need to sample a few to be able to extrapolate that information to the entire batch. In other words, you should only need to take a few samples in order to, a few samples that are representative of the batch in order to make conclusions about the batch. We can go on to the next slide. What's the relationship between decision unit and population? A population is defined as a set of objects or a volume of material that share a common characteristic. So sometimes population will be synonymous with decision unit, but at times they are not going to be the same thing. For example, you could have two populations that exist within a single decision unit. And say here your decision unit is a residential yard. And it's possible that you want to determine an average over that yard. And you take samples to determine the average. But you find out that your average is above your exposure limit. So you're going to have to clean up the yard. But you suspect that there's really dirty areas in the yard and clean areas. And that the dirty areas are what is really pushing your mean up. Now, do you really want to clean up a lot of clean soil? Or would you rather just clean up the dirty soil and dispose of it? So within that yard, you may have two populations, one's clean and one's dirty. When you're making a decision on an average, they get averaged together. But if you have to clean it up, you're going to want to separate out those two populations. The other scenario where they are not synonymous is if a population is really large, so that more than one decision unit is needed to cover it. And this happens a lot where you have large areas like, you know, 50 acres, 100 acres that are suspected to be dirty or suspected to be clean, but you're going to have to sample it in order to demonstrate that it's clean or dirty. And that's just too large to work with all at once. So it gets split up into decision units based on the decision. Is it a risk decision? Then it's going to get split up into exposure units. If there are other decisions, they're going to have their own spatial units. We can move on to the next slide. Just as we talked about sample supports, we can talk about decision unit supports. And again, it refers to the same concept, that your decision unit is going to have certain spatial dimensions, an area, a depth, and maybe a particle size that you're interested in. Maybe there's other physical properties that you're interested in that affect what kind of concentrations you're going to get. So you have to control for that variable in order to get representative data. But your decision is what defines the population of interest, and the population defines the properties of the samples. Therefore, the support of your sample, the dimensions of your sample, has to mimic the support for the decision unit, except they're on different spatial scales. We can go to the next slide. And here is, again, it's a cartoon. Please don't read too much into this example. It's supposed to be simplistic, and you're going to have questions like, well, how do you do this in real life? This is much simpler than what happens in real life. It is just to teach the concept of decision support, and don't read anything into it beyond that. So this is trying to illustrate the idea of decision unit support, sample support, and representativeness and how they fit together. This cartoon is meant to represent a scenario where you have a soil profile and the decision is, can it be shown that atmospheric deposition caused contamination? And because it's recent atmospheric deposition, we know we are dealing with the top of the soil surface. Now, what I have given you in the graphic is I'm telling you that that top layer of brown soil is the layer impacted by deposition. That's just a given in this cartoon. The question now is, what is the sample support that is most representative of the decision? Well, the decision has to do with atmospheric deposition. And we've told you that the brown layer is the layer impacted by atmospheric deposition. So, the answer is number one, as far as the options that you have there. Number two is not representative because it goes down and it grabs a lot of material from a population that is not part of the decision you're trying to make. You want to know the concentration in that layer, and you don't want to be grabbing material from places that are not part of that layer. With the sample support number 3, you have the same issue. Now, sample support number 1, that's the best option of the 3. But some of you out there may be thinking, which is good, thinking, well, maybe there's actually a better sample support than number 1. And you will be right. The best sample support is one that goes down to the base of that layer, that ground layer. So it would just be extending the sample support of number 1 a little bit further to the base of the layer. Now, I know you're all thinking, how would you do this in real life? Again, because we always get this in class, this is just to teach the concept. That's all. To go on to the next slide, and here I want to show you that this also applies to groundwater. And we're not talking about groundwater here, but it's important to understand that this whole issue of sample support, it's about more than just soil, and the same thing happens in aquifers. A lot of you are probably familiar with membrane interface probes that are used on the end of direct push. They're used as a type of sensor that as you push down through the soil, you can actually generate readings of contaminants as you go down. And the analyte here in this instance was TCE. And as the sensor was pushed down through the ground, you got the results that are in green, where there was nothing, and then down around 30 feet, the sensor started responding. And then it drops off again down to about 40 feet. If you go to the next slide. Now, say this is, you know, what we just saw was the reality. These sensors can take readings every 2 inches if you want. So they can get a very confident picture of what's going on in the subsurface. But say we didn't know it was down there. We just put a well in. That's why we put wells in, because we want to find out what's going on down there. But we happen to put a well screen there where you can see the sort of screened area on the picture. So we've missed the contaminated area, but we draw water from the well and have it analyzed. And since the results come back as non-detect or low, we decide there's nothing there. On the other hand, if we go on to slide 39, you know, perhaps by chance, the geologist or hydrologist decided that, well, we're going to put the well screen down a little further. Now, give a chance here. Hopefully your slides will come up. Okay. And when the slide comes up for you, you'll see that the screen now is set at the level where you would be picking up the contaminated groundwater, where the sensor said that contamination is hanging out. Now, if you took a sample and sent it off to the lab, you would get back very high results. On the other hand, and again, moving on to the next slide, slide 40, these are animations in real life, but because we can't do animations on this delivery mechanism, they end up being separate slides. So on the last slide of the series there, slide 40, say the hydrogeologist decided to put in a longer well screen than we were using before. But that longer well screen actually brackets both the contaminated portion of the aquifer and a portion of the aquifer where the contamination isn't hanging out. Assuming that you get equal return of water into the well from both of those areas, it's easy to see how you would end up with groundwater concentrations that are intermediate between the first well and the second well. So again, this idea of sample support applies to water. Where are you placing your well screen? How wide, how long is the well screen? Where is it getting water from? Is it mixing clean water with contaminated water? How much mixing is there? It's very easy to understand why sometimes on quarterly monitoring, the data seems to bounce around a lot. And it's not the lab's fault. It's the variability in the subsurface that's interacting with the variability in the sampling program. to give you variable results. If you go to slide 41, which is the last slide in this presentation, sort of the summary of all that we've talked about so far is that the biggest cause of misleading data is not lab analysis. It's the heterogeneity of the matrices that we have to work with. And, you can't fool Mother Nature. You can pretend that you can take one sample from a large soil area and draw a conclusion about a large soil volume based on a single sample. And you can fool yourself that that might be true, but that doesn't mean that that's the reality. So controlling for sample variability is very, very important. And so before we can talk about XRF, we really need to figure out how to control these things and understand them, because as you probably noticed, XRF is a very small sample support. Therefore, there is a lot of opportunity for highly variable results. So before we can use XRF and compare it with other analytical tools, we have to understand what kind of variables we're going to have to control when we design an XRF program. And that's it for my presentation.
So with the remaining time that we have, those of you who are on the phone lines, if you have any questions for Dina or Steve, feel free to feel free to unmute your phone lines right now. You can do that by pressing #6. Go ahead and identify yourself and ask your question. If there aren't any questions from the individual on the phone line, those of you who are streaming the audio, you can go ahead and use that question mark icon to submit them online. We have over 200 people that joined us today live, so we have a pretty good turnout.
I'd like to go back to slide 36,
okay,
if we could. And just, one of Dina's comments, the slide 36 is the one which is, which sample support is representative of the decision. And, of course, the release mechanism in this case is a aerial deposition or atmospheric deposition. And, of course, we all noted that the best sample support for that one was number one. But the question that we get that often comes up is, how do I know? If I don't know the depth of that layer, how am I to determine that in the field? And we have this conversation oftentimes when we deliver it live, that in the case where you don't know what the depth of that atmospheric deposition is, we've used a sample support, at least initially, that is more representative of number two there, where we're taking a core, and with a tool like XRF, what's nice is that you get the real-time information, you can actually either collect subsamples along the length of the core, or we've actually laid out core and simply gone in situ shots, if you will, along the length of the core to figure out at what depth are we seeing the deposition, the impacts of deposition drop off. So you would start at the surface and work your way down to 6 inches, a foot, 2 feet to try to figure out where you're seeing the concentrations that are indicative of the atmospheric deposition drop off. Now, you need to be careful that you're not looking at different matrices and historical impacts and other things, but we have used a similar core-type application to figure out, at least initially, what we think that depth of that appropriate decision unit might be.
Yeah.
So that's one way to interpret that slide 36 as a real-world application of how you might go about figuring out what is truly the appropriate sample support in that case.
There was actually a question that came in online regarding that slide.
Yeah.
And the question is, on slide 36, if sample 3 were split in half by depth, shouldn't one get an additional negative confirmation of deposition effects?
I suppose if you took the bottom half.
Right. And we often get that question as well. I think I neglected to say on this slide, and I should have, is what the sample support means is that for that area outlined in white, if you take a sample support of that area, you take it and you mix it all up. So for a given sample support, the idea is that you want the average concentration over that entire volume. And I think I neglected to mention that before, and that is important to understanding what those figures mean. So if you split it in half, it's no longer a single sample support, it's two different sample supports. And if you extend your question to say, how higher is the concentration in the atmospheric deposition layer than the concentration below, then you're looking at two sample supports, one from the atmospheric deposition layer and one from a layer that is not impacted by atmospheric deposition.
There's another question that came in as well on slide 21. You talked about how a specific number, 350, that on the surface appears safely below the action level, let's say 400, may not really be statistically distinguishable at the action level. You alluded to the fact that the number is usually used as if, or as is, even if the DQO for the associated lab duplicate is not met. In the real world, how do you convince a client that a result of 350 is still dirty and needs to have action taken, even if only to spend money on the collection and analysis of more samples?
Well, it comes down to how certain do you want to be. If you have that 350, it could mean that it's clean. It could mean that it's dirty. Flip a coin to make the decision. And that's sort of what you say to your client. There is enough, you say to them, there's a lot of variability in real-world matrices, and we have this number, but it's close to the action level, and the amount of variability in our matrix is such that it could be either or. And do you want to make a decision based on flipping a coin? Either do you want to commit to cleaning up based on flipping a coin, or do you want to commit to saying there is no risk? Flipping the coin. And hopefully they will say that, no, they'd rather make those decisions with some level of confidence, better than 50-50. And, you tell them that for data points that are close enough to the action level and where there's enough variability that you can't be sure, it's going to be cheaper in the long run, either cleanup cost-wise or from a public concern perspective, to answer those questions rather than deal with what we deal with a lot now, which is you have a single data set. Two opposing parties can interpret that data set completely differently because there is so much ambiguity in the data. And then the ones that make money are the lawyers as we argue back and forth, whereas if you just went out and took some more samples in the right places and did the right things with them, you can answer those questions and eliminate a lot of the controversy and make decisions that people really felt good about, confident about, and knew that they weren't wasting money or facing excessive risk.
And I think, the other part to that, too, is tying it back to XRF, is the value of the real-time analysis of XRF and the higher data density that you get. So, you're getting essentially a real-time number for 350. How close are you to that action level of 400? And what you need to basically go back to your client with is the concept of decision error and what a decision error means. And Dina kind of alluded to the fact that, do you want to make a decision error about cleaning something up or potentially exposing someone? So, with a tool like XRF, you're going to get a higher data density so that if you do, you'll understand the variability around that 350 number better. And we also, later on in subsequent modules, we'll talk about things like field-based action levels where we'll have an upper and lower investigation level where we'll use XRF confidently to say we're clean below this number and dirty above this number. And then certain samples will fall into a range where it's too close to call given the variability that we have. We might send those samples off for a more definitive laboratory analysis via ICP.
Or we might also just increase the number of XRF analyses. You can do that easy with bags. You collect a bag of dirt and take a number of readings over the bag. And I think we're going to talk about that in subsequent modules as well and show some examples of projects that have done that. where take initial four readings, and you know you, the results go straight into a spreadsheet when you're out in the field. And I've had the computer on my lap as the XRF operator gives me the numbers, and right away I can say, we can't make our decision. We're too close to the action level. There's too much variability. There's overlap. So right away he takes another six shots over the bag, and I enter them. And a lot of times by the time you take 10 XRF shots, you've got your decision. You're sure it's clean, you're sure it's dirty, or maybe it's still too close to call, but you already, you know, you have decision rules about how to handle it if it still seems too close to call. But you've certainly eliminated a lot of the uncertainty, and it doesn't add, it adds some time certainly to the field work, but it's a lot better than getting the data back 3 months later and having to remobilize and a whole group of people all over again to go out and take more samples to resolve uncertainties.
Yeah, the cost is really in obtaining the sample. With XRF, the beauty of it, as Bob mentioned in the first session, is that it's non-destructive. So if you need to go back and continue to assess variability, whether it's across a bag, and in situ across a decision unit, or even within a cup, you have the ability to do that in real time. And again, going back to the decision error piece, I think we always have to live with some uncertainty regarding decisions about whether it's clean or dirty. And so, you know, that's why we have things like, well, we can live with a 5% false positive error or a 5% false negative error and a 10% false positive error, because we recognize that even with the best analytical results, when you factor in all the sampling variabilities and all the other uncertainties, that you have to live with some percentage of incorrect decisions. So we try to minimize, most often we try to minimize those that have an impact to a potential receptor. And those are where the XRF is potentially going to tell us that we're clean, yet the true value is above some action level. That's the one that we really want to watch out for, and that's the one that we try to manage to in the field using a tool like XRF. And oftentimes we can live with a slightly higher decision level or error limit with a false positive where XRF is saying we're above a certain threshold value, and all that results in is either taking some additional data or potentially excavating a small portion of material that is actually truly below the value. So there's a trade-off there, and you need to discuss that with your client in terms of what are you willing to live with in terms of decision errors, and then you can show the power of how XRF can help both manage and manage those decision errors and make decisions in real time, so that when you get to that decision point, you have a higher degree of confidence, and you also understand, you know, how variable things are in the field as they're happening, and you can react to those, as Dina's example illustrated.
We have another question that came in online, and they ask, considering the following: number one, human health risk is almost always driven by incidental ingestion or dust inhalation. Particle sizes less than, say, 2 millimeters are likely the most representative. And number two, for leachability of contamination from the surface of soil particles, the smaller particle sizes would carry a higher mass of adsorbed chemical per unit volume of soil particle size. So therefore, why is there not a considered effort to sample only 2 millimeters and smaller particle sizes? The only exception would be in cases where the contamination is pure particles of some chemical, such as chunks of lead.
Well, because we make more decisions than just risk decisions. Like I say, you can be making a disposal decision. You could be making a remediation decision. So certainly when you're making a risk-related decision, I think that what you described is what is becoming much more common, commonly done based on regulator input. We have to leave it open, though, that you are free to decide on different sample supports if a decision requires a different sample support.
So, I mean, the reality in terms of a remedial decision, let's take a simple dig and haul as an example, you cannot preferentially remove those particle sizes, so your decision in that case, even though your risk decision may be driven by the smaller particle sizes, in which case you need to focus your sample support in that direction, if your remedy is a dig and haul, you're left with removing the bulk volume. Therefore, the decision is made on a much different decision unit, which is the total volume of soil encompassing all those different particle sizes. So hopefully that answers the question.
Another way that this information on particle size and metals can be used is soil washing as a remedial technology. I know it's, I don't think they use it as much as they used to, but the basis of soil washing was it flushed away those smaller particle sizes. And what was left behind had a lot lower concentrations than what was removed. What can be done with this type of data is determine how do I structure my washing procedures so that I remove the most amount of lead by flushing away, you know, what are all the particle sizes I have to be able to flush away to get a lead concentration that's acceptable. Again, that's a different decision, and you would structure the sampling and analysis a little differently than you would for a risk decision.
So, again, if there's anyone on the phone lines that has any questions, feel free to speak up. Only the online people have the questions today. That's okay. We have a few more moments. If you do have any last remaining questions, feel free to submit them using the question mark icon now. You can also email any of the instructors after today's event. You'll find their email addresses hotlinked on the homepage. So if you're to click on the icon that has a house on it on top of the slide, that'll bring you to the homepage with contact information. If there aren't any remaining questions at this point, I'm going to guide everyone to the final slide in today's session, and that is slide number 43, where you'll find two very important links. The first one will bring you to the additional resources that we've compiled for this particular topic. It's got a few websites. There's some documents that you can download, as well as the opportunity to save the slides. There's also the second link on slide 43 takes you to our feedback form, and we would ask that you just take a moment or two to fill it out and let us know what you thought of today's event. Let us know, technically speaking, if it went well, just looking at how we delivered it, if it worked. We do read that information, and we do actively try to use that to help improve our delivery in the future. This was the second seminar in an 8-part seminar series. The next session will be delivered next Monday, the same time, same place. If you haven't done so already, please go to cluein.org/training and sign up for the remaining sessions on XRF that we'll be offering this month in August. Peter, Steve, do you have any other questions?
Looks like we had one additional question come in. We've got a couple minutes left if we want to try to answer it.
All right, that last question that came in online says, if time allows, this is slightly off topic, an earlier slide discussed lead concentrations increasing as particle size decreases. We have a site that is a large former firing range where we have a high lead concentration in the impact and ricochet areas where we also observe slugs, but also in surrounding areas where no observed evidence of slugs or metal fragments exist. Group experience or knowledge, is this from the lead dust from when the bullets hit the hillside backstop?
I think that's certainly possible. I'm not a firing range expert. We know one. If this is important and you want to connect up with some people who have a lot of experience with firing ranges. But yes, from what I've read, when the bullet impacts, there definitely is fragmentation that can happen at a very, very fine particle size. And then with weathering over, you know, some of these things are 20, 30, 50 years old, I guess, if they go back to World War II or World War I. And so then the lead does pretty much disintegrate into an elemental form for at least a portion of the lead.
And we have a case study that I'll talk a little bit about in the demonstration of methods applicability piece, referring to the Fort Lewis case study, and we know some folks that did the work there. They actually saw significant ricochet and found on the backside of the firing berms higher lead concentrations that they weren't expected, and it's interesting that you don't see, you see higher lead concentrations in areas where you're not observing slugs or metal fragments. That's kind of interesting, but the fact remains is that if they're high enough impact, they could essentially, the particles are so small that you wouldn't visually see the evidence of the lead, but you can still have the contamination in those other areas. Or as Dina mentioned, weathering and other water or other things moving particles preferentially in a certain direction, you can get higher lead concentrations away from what you would away from the impact and ricochet areas. But again, if you need more information, we'd be happy to put you in touch with some folks that have a lot of work on firing ranges.
Well, I thank everyone, our instructors, as well as those of you joining us on the phone lines and the simulcast today for participating in part two of the eight-part XRF seminar series here on CLUIN. Again, I redirect you back to the additional resources where you can download the slides, take a moment to fill out that feedback form, and also visit the homepage of the seminar and feel free to submit questions to Dina, Steve, or Bob afterwards because they will address them in the next part, part three, which will be delivered next Monday. Thank you all very much, and I hope you have a great day.